my own time. I'll try to keep myself on time.
Great.
Give myself
thank
a
you.
5-minute warning. Okay. Thank you very much, Henry, and thanks for your initiative and Harold to get these communities together, planetary science community and terrestrial soil science community. A couple of things. You might have noticed there's a sign in the back of the room that no alcohol beyond that point. So if any of you have alcohol, I think many of us could use it this morning. And secondly, I'll give some sort of perspective and overview and summary topics, but I'll tell you, I'm personally here to learn. You know, hearing from Arjun and some of the others in the terrestrial science, soil science community is just incredibly important for us planetary scientists because, you know, damn it, we can't go to our field site, you know, as much as we want to. But the terrestrial community, of course, gets to spend lots of time at their field sites. And they just have a real connection to the land and the landscape that is just incredibly difficult to get in planetary sciences. You know, we try to go out on field trips and take our students where we can and use the earth as an analog, but ultimately to try to figure out what's going on out there. And some of you may have seen Doug Ming's talk next door, and you know the experience that we're having with these rovers is that people who come in from the terrestrial sedimentology and stratigraphy community are making enormous contributions to planetary science because they are able to experience the land and the landscape firsthand and apply that knowledge to situations where we can't go out and touch and dig or bring samples back. So I think that same kind of collaboration in the soil science community will be incredibly valuable, not just for Mars, but for other planets as well. But I'll just mostly talk about Mars and give you some highlights. What do we know about the properties of fine-grained regolith components on Mars? I won't hit everything that we know, but I'll just hit some of the high points, and we can discuss more in more detail. Dust, soil, clay, size, materials, sand, pebbles, cobbles, spherules, grindings, tailings, and rock coatings. Some of this is naturally occurring. Some of it is because we've got these vehicles, rovers and landers, actually, you know, interacting with the surface, sort of as proxies for ourselves, trying to do things that we would do out in the, or our graduate students would do out in the field. And then talk about, you know, given some of these properties, and I know people coming after this presentation will go into much more detail in many aspects of this. What does it tell us about environmental conditions on Mars, including the potential habitability of the surface and the subsurface? Of course, that's something that drives a lot of what NASA and other space agencies do on Mars and other places in the solar system, looking for evidence that these environments were habitable or potentially still inhabited, and thinking about the future habitability of these places for potential human exploration. So Arjun's talk was a really good introduction to this chart because, Arjun, we need another word that goes way beyond hyper-arid, okay? Hyper-arid for you guys is like a garden spot on Mars, right? So this is a plot of mean annual temperature versus mean annual precipitation. Right, and so everything Arjun was talking about was up here, okay, and it's a log plot on the x-axis, okay. So you know the Atacama is you know somewhere you know down in here, actually up here, higher temperature, right? But it's sort of on this you know this scale of tens to hundreds of millimeters. Mars is like pushed up against the x-axis. Mars today is right on the x-axis and way down here. Okay, mean annual temperature is you know, well below freezing point, depending upon latitude, 30, 50, 60 degrees latitude. A mean annual precipitation, of course, today, zero, right? And there are various models. There's a hypothesis that there was a really warm and wet Mars based on evidence that you've all seen from spacecraft data, river channels, evidence of fluvial activity on the surface being seen from orbit, now being seen from rovers and landers on the surface. Okay, but even that putative warm and wet Mars probably only very, you know, barely got up into this glacial regime, maybe periglacial. Right, it's 50% further from the sun, so the solar input is low. So you know we're talking about extremely, extremely arid environment by terrestrial standards. Okay, so we have to calibrate ourselves that way to what hyper-arid really is in this planetary context. And we have to calibrate ourselves on timescale as well, right? everything on Mars is Precambrian, essentially. Right? Everything that's out there is, you know, from the earliest history of Mars, same age of planet as the Earth, of course, but all the action was early, 3.5 billion years ago when this putative warm and wet environment was existing. So, you know, people struggle to understand Precambrian soils on the Earth because they're just not preserved. But everything that's preserved there is Precambrian. In fact, it's Archean. Some of it is Hadean. That's the kind of material that we're dealing with in those timescales. And because of this, and that Arjun's E term is so ridiculously low, that these materials are preserved. And so we have to calibrate ourselves to think as geologists and soil scientists of processes that we would regard as insignificant on our own planet, but allowed to run for billions of years. And what can those do to create soils, to initiate pedogenesis in the absence of biology, or perhaps in the early presence of biology? So, you know, I'll talk a little bit about dust, for example, and how we think of dust on the Earth versus how we think of dust on Mars. So it's just important, I think, to calibrate ourselves to what aridity means, what the temperatures means, and those effects on soil formation and erosion and the timescales. Henry showed this one, right? There's been this armada from planet Earth exploring Mars. We've got two rovers active on the surface, multiple orbiters up above taking high-resolution data going down on the surface. We've been down there since the 1970s, the Viking landers observing some of the first soil-like deposits, Aeolian windblown dust materials, and then the Mars Pathfinder, the first little rover on Mars, encountering little bed forms and dune forms on the surface. More recently, we've had much more robust capability with these vehicles like Spirit and Opportunity. You can see the scale here, okay? And this is a spacecraft. It has all the same materials and systems as an orbiter around a planet or a geostationary satellite. It's got comm, it's got power, it's got thermal, computers inside. It just happens to be on wheels, and it happens to be on the surface, and it happens to give us mobility, which is, of course, the precious thing for field geologists, right? Arjun wouldn't drop out of his helicopter and just stand there, right? He's going to run up to the top of the mountain, drive around. That mobility has been absolutely critical for Spirit, Opportunity, and their big cousin, Curiosity. Both Opportunity and Curiosity still operating on Mars. Opportunity will be 13 years on Mars this January. Curiosity just passed 4. So, larger a vehicle, more capabilities, I'll talk about in a moment, but also the same kind of basic suspension system and mobility capabilities. So, you know, this is as good as we can do for our field work, and it's very, very restricted compared to what we would do on the Earth. Can't do your cosmogenic nuclei work. I mean, it'd be great, love it, right? But so far, nobody's figured out how to turn that machine that you use into a shoebox. People are working on it, so it'll happen eventually, but we're just not there yet. So a wide variety of fine-grained, mobile regolith materials, the same kind of standards that we talk about in terrestrial soil science community. These include dust, which is micron-sized, so really smoke-sized particles, clay-sized soils, silt, sand, in traditional sense, clasts, pebbles, plus, of course, you know, outcrop, coarser-grained rocks, boulders, and these are the precursors, the protolith, for the fine grain materials that we see on the surface. Give you sort of a quick little picture show, right? Here's a image from the Spirit rover relatively early in its mission. And just driving across the surface, most surfaces on Mars are dusty, covered with this reddish brown, fine grained soil component that is airfall, Aeolian airfall. But it's a very thin skin. Below that, all it takes is just driving a wheel over it, and it exposes much lower albedo and much more basaltic soil component on the surface. I had an animation that didn't quite work, but if you were to see this animation move, you'd see these little dust devils and a really big one come right across the rover here. So it's an active environment on Mars, even though the surface pressure is only 1% of this room. The wind does move particles around. The threshold velocities are right to move dust, to lift dust into the atmosphere, to keep it entrained for weeks to months at a time in the atmosphere, and to move sand grains around through saltation and creep. So the conditions are good for moving particles around, even though the atmospheric pressure is very low. Here's a view from the Curiosity rover as it was landing, coming down. There's a movie, spectacular movie online you can watch from the descent camera. And this is when the retro rockets are just the first time they see the surface. And so you can see that dusty layer being blown away from the retro rocket point. And it actually exposed a whole bunch of interesting materials for us in that process. So in general, it's a very dusty place where we've sent landers and rovers. I'll show you one counterexample of a not very dusty place, although even that is somewhat dusty. And that dust can be lifted up for long periods of time, right? It's a very, very mobile and globally homogenized component that's sitting in the soil. So, you know, it's sort of true on the Earth as well. If you think about, you know, if you had the capability to measure in extremely fine detail, you'd see, you know, a lust component from, you know, sandstorms in the Sahara or, you know, wind in China, in all terrestrial soils in some sense. There is a homogenization process that goes on the Earth, but of course our planet is dynamic and that stuff is blown away, washed away by water and glaciers. Not the case on Mars. This stuff is globally homogenized. Occasionally, this is one of the recent, this is from the Hubble Space Telescope, one of the recent large-scale planet-encircling dust storms. And it takes weeks and weeks and weeks for that to settle out. And it settles out on everything. It becomes a really important local component that makes it very difficult in many places to do remote sensing. Because, you know, of course, most of our sensing is just looking at the uppermost few microns, visible, or maybe 100 microns in the thermal infrared. And, you know, we could easily have hundreds, thousands of microns, centimeters of this stuff in some places that prevent us from seeing the lithology of the intrinsic material below. Nonetheless, we know that a lot of these dark areas are basaltic, and that's been verified on the ground. Here's what one of those dark areas looks like. It's a sort of a big sand erg piled up against a hill, imaged by the Spirit rover. We couldn't drive the rover into it because it's kind of a rover death trap, but we could drive up to it, and it was great to be able to put the arm out and make measurements of the chemistry and mineralogy of this extremely common basaltic sand. It's all over Mars. It's globally transported just like the dust. There are local sources in places, but there's also probably a global component of this. Again, we have to take the time scale into mind, right? On the Earth, sand dunes are moving extremely slowly. On Mars, they're moving extremely slowly, although we have data now on how slowly they're moving because we've got 30, 40 years of orbital measurements of them built up over time. And you know, in any given day with a rover, we might see a couple of sand grains hop. Boop, oh, wow, big day on Mars. That sand grain hopped, you know? And so on any given day, it seems insignificant. We'd ignore those kinds of things in our field site on the Earth. But let that process run for billions of years. Billions of years, where the most interesting thing that's happening besides the sand grain hopping is a rover driving past, right? We just don't have our heads around that as geologists, terrestrial geologists, I think. It's a difficult thing. That sand fills in the low places. Here's one of the craters, Endurance Crater, that we visited with the Opportunity rover. Also, you know, rover death trap, can't drive into it. There are ripples that migrate across the surface, pretty spectacular, beautiful kinds of landscape images. But it's active. These are active, actively moving across the surface. We actually got the Opportunity rover stuck in some of those ripples at one point during the mission for several weeks. These wheels are about 15 centimeters in diameter and, you know, totally buried up to the wheel. It took 3 weeks of spinning the wheel backwards to get out. We were able to do that, but we hadn't appreciated how incredibly fine and powdery these deposits are, even though they're macroscopically thick and they look much more coherent than they are. Again, very slow, gentle processes integrated over enormous amounts of time can produce resulting physical properties that are non-intuitive. We had to learn that the hard way. Here's where the Opportunity rover has been driving around since 2005. four looks a lot like, you know, the empty quarter of the Sahara, for example. In fact, this was called Rub al Khali for exactly that reason, this place. I have friends who are Aeolian geomorphologists and they love it, okay, but otherwise it's not particularly interesting. It's just a place you got to get to the next crater for this mission, which we're sampling the subsurface. So we try not to spend a lot of time here, but this is actually where we get stuck, just driving, plowing through one of these ripples, where plowing is at 3 centimeters per second, you know, like that. Plowing into it, and we don't drive these things in real time. You tell a rover, okay, go 100 meters today, go 200 meters today, call us when you get there. And it goes off and does it. And in this case, we just plowed right into one of these ripples, didn't appreciate or respect its physical properties, and blew almost a month of the mission, not stuck in it. We were talking about salts, right? And we found them on Mars. These are not chloride salts in this place. These are sulfate salts. And the funny story on this one is that, you know, the Spirit rover's right front wheel motors broke many years into the mission, so we couldn't drive forward anymore. We had to drive backwards. The wheel is locked. I'll show you an movie in a moment. The wheel is locked, so driving backwards with the locked wheel creates a trench. And so it's digging this trench through here, through these deposits, which looked otherwise pretty much like everything else around. We had no idea that just below the subsurface there's all these very concentrated deposits of sulfate salts in places unexpectedly sulfur-rich. And Doug Ming and others have talked about this. Maybe Doug will talk about it more later in the session. And then silica-rich soils as well. These are these leached materials, are these sinter deposits. Lots of debate going on among the team, but the place that we're in is lots of evidence for volcanic rocks, frothy volcanic bombs. This big plateau we're driving around may be the eroded roots of an ancient sinter cone, probably a hydrothermal environment. And the exciting thing about this was that, you know, seeing these materials, which you see similar kinds of minerals at Yellowstone and elsewhere, tells us that there were hydrothermal fluids interacting with heat sources, interacting with the surface. That's a habitable environment, you know, maybe 3.5-4 billion years ago, not today. But that was an exciting thing. From the perspective of this rover. Let's see if I can get this movie to work here. Oh, the guy had it working before. Let's try it. Darn it. Anyway, if you could see this movie, you'd see that this is where the Spirit rover got stuck and still is. We had a similar experience. Unanticipated, looked like a normal terrain to drive over. This is a very crusted terrain. You can see a little bit of evidence in the fracturing here of the crusty nature of this soil. So there's a cementing agent in here that we haven't really fully identified, but it, you know, could be salt, probably salt related, but it could be iron oxides or some other component. A cementing agent in here. Drove the rover across it. Turned out we were driving across a very small impact crater that had been filled in with this soil through erosion and transport, and the rover just went boop right down into it. Winter came along, we're spinning the wheels backwards, couldn't get out, the sun was too low in the sky, the solar panels got dusty, and their Spirit sits today in that spot. And we lost the ability to command the rover anymore. Still there, nobody's taken it. So. Back at Opportunity, we also discovered these coarse-grained components of the soil, these spherule components, which I don't have time to get into too much, but they're, you know, they're sort of the size of BBs or ball bearings. We call them blueberries because they're bluer than the rocks around, the soils around them, although everything is very red and dusty. And we think these are concretions, kind of the analogy of Moki marbles here in the Southwest, forming from inundation of very porous rock with water and the slow removal of that water through evaporation or transport in an isotropic homogeneous way. And just like here in the Southwest, you can grow these sort of spherical grains, and they can get ping pong ball size here, Utah and elsewhere. And they're just sort of ball bearing size on Mars in this place. But great evidence that there really was a groundwater system there inundating these rocks. And those blueberries are a lag sitting on the surface. So this is an actively eroding, deflating surface at extremely low rates. That deflation, it erodes away these sulfate-bearing, hydrated, rocks that form lots of the outcrop in this area. So again, interaction of groundwater altering the basaltic protolith into these sulfates, hydrated sulfates, and other kinds of hydrated minerals. And leaves, these are iron-rich. These grains are iron-rich. They're the they have hematite in them. We saw that signal from Orbit, a group here at ASU under Professor Christensen helped make that discovery. And they just get left behind as a lag deposit. And if you just dig a little bit down into the surface, into these very fine soils, you get below that lag deposit. So it's just slowly eroding down over time, leaving these coarser-grained spherules, which we interpret as concretions. At least that's the leading hypothesis in these areas. You can see an area where some have actually rolled across the surface here, creating this little tiny mini channel. I mentioned the retro rockets of Curiosity coming down, cleared off the landing zone, and helped us recognize conglomerates on the surface, pebbles and cobbles. Here's the scale, 1 centimeter. If you go out in your backyard and decide you want to rip your basketball court out and break up the cement, this is what you're going to see, right? It's this conglomerate kind of material. And many of the pebbles and cobbles in here are rounded, okay? And these things have been traveling kilometers across the landscape down the crater rim where, in the crater that Curiosity is, transported across the surface. Because of their size, the wind can't do it. These are fluvially transported sedimentary rocks. We're sitting at the base of the alluvial fan or a sort of a mini deltaic kind of deposit inside of a crater, and water has come coursing down this crater over the early in the geologic history of the planet. So very kind of instant discovery just through the morphology from the rover. Now luckily we can do more than just morphology. Both vehicles have spectrometers on board, active and passive, so we can get a whole bunch of squiggly line science. As well, it's as close as we can come to doing the kinds of sample analyses that we would do if we took these materials in the lab: multispectral imaging, infrared spectroscopy, APXS for elemental composition, and Mossbauer spectroscopy for some mineralogy. So work that we're doing with my student Danica Wellington, for example, looking at multispectral data. So the pictures that you see from Mars are in these red, green, blue bands here, but the camera will work out into near infrared. And we could see evidence for hematite absorption features in some of the data matching what we see from Orbit, providing some ground truth. And then when we start to look at these drill holes, which Curiosity is able to make, we get very different kinds of spectra that show evidence of perhaps some kind of a hydrated iron 3+ bearing material. We're still trying to tease this out. And some of them just have these relatively flat spectra that imply the existence of spectrally neutral materials like magnetite. The beauty of this is that we can ingest these materials into an XRD device and do detailed mineralogy. I'll talk about that in a second. We can zap them with the LIBS, remote LIBS, to get elemental chemistry now on thousands and thousands of samples. So it's a real statistical data set on elemental chemistry. The Mossbauer spectrometer on Opportunity and Spirit is partly what tells us that those little spherule grains are hematite-rich. It's a beautiful, classic Mossbauer sextet. We see that in the infrared spectra as well. And then going back to Curiosity, bringing those drill tailings into the rover to do detailed organic chemistry analysis and XRD is incredibly important. And notice how red Mars becomes gray Mars. You just get below the surface, okay? And you get below that ubiquitous dust. It's everywhere. Spectacular XRD data from the instrument inside Curiosity. I'll bet Doug Ming's going to talk more about that, these beautiful spectra that allow us to do a real mineralogic inventory of, in this case, it's a basaltic sand. I mean, this is, it's not to see the details, but just a classic terrestrial garden variety basalt, except that there's like almost 30% of some amorphous component that is X-ray amorphous, and so very, very difficult for the team to analyze and figure out. So a variety of different strategies going into that. You can pull out all this information from the squiggly line science and get a look at the kinds of mineral inventories that are occurring at the different landing sites, evidence for classical olivine and pyroxene. It's a basaltic planet. It's a basaltic protolith. But also, a bunch of oxides in here, some interesting low pH kind of sulfate, hydrated sulfates like jarosite, evidence for carbonates, and evidence for a lot of smectite clay, formed in an aqueous environment from the Curiosity website, where we're seeing mudstones after mudstones after mudstones. If you saw Doug's talk, you saw some beautiful pictures of that terrain. Lots of evidence for groundwater motivated transport of material, fluvial transport, precipitation of minerals. We think this is gypsum veins at the opportunity site, clay coatings at the opportunity site, consistent with what we're seeing from orbit, and just some spectacular evidence of groundwater fracture fill at the Curiosity site in Gale Crater. So lots of movement of water going on, and just some statistical data from all of these measurements we have in hand now, and others may talk more about this as I'm running out of time, but sort of, you know, trends in aluminum silica, magnesium silica that tell us about silica enrichment, about aluminum enrichment, that tell us about open or closed system leaching environments. We see, you know, weathering trends that are very consistent with sort of straightforward alteration, chemical and physical, of basaltic precursors, but occasionally strays off the path into the sulfates, into the clays, where because these landing sites are so well chosen to optimize, we think there might have been evidence of a watery past here, that maybe it's not surprising. If you were to do Mars overall, you'd be dominantly on this basaltic line. And then everything, of course, is related to the protolith, the primary mineralogy. This is a standard basaltic classification plot from Hath McSween, and all the rocks from various missions are up here, and you can see lots of basalts, also some more exotic compositions up here, some basaltic andesite and andesites, and in general, the soil plots right in here. There is a globally homogenized component to that through the dust and the sand, and it is primarily basaltic. But you've seen there are local deviations from that that reflect local sources, and that's where a lot of the excitement is. So just to conclude here, and this is, I think, hopefully be a good lead-in to the next talk by this paper that includes Ron. I really like this quote. Classifying extraterrestrial soils helps focus our attention on environments or conditions on Earth that are integrated to the conditions of our nearby neighbors, and positions pedology to provide increased scientific input towards future planetary missions and data analysis. And everybody knows, of course, our goal is to get here. Very curious about what this community thinks about this, and whether you guys had as many problems with the botany parts of it as us in the planetary community had with the planetary science parts of it. But you know, at the end of the day, the work that we're doing with these robotic emissaries, again, the best we can do. Of course, we'd all love to be there ourselves. We can't do that yet, but we can use these silicon and aluminum and titanium friends to collect a variety of measurements that I think are giving us a lot of insight that will be extremely useful, of course, just scientifically in understanding soil formation and evolution processes in general in a planetary context, but of course getting us ready for that happy day when we actually do get our boots into the red dirt. Thank you.
So we have a few minutes for questions, taking advantage of Jim being here. So, yes?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you have such long time periods of particles moving around, what happens to the angularity?
Yeah.
Is it a lot of rounding happening? Did it become very rounded? Or is it enough physical weathering that it's all apart again?
Great question about, you know, what happens to the angularity of the particles. So in places where the transport has been relatively short, you know, tens of kilometers or less, like in Gale Crater, these sediments coming down the wall of the crater and being deposited in this fan-shaped deposit that the rover actually landed on, and then being cemented into this conglomerate structure and preserved, you do see that kind of rounding, sort of standard particle transport rounding of cobbles and pebbles. Elsewhere, though, you know, as the basaltic lava flows and pyroclastic deposits and all that are just being physically broken down, they get transported by the wind, maybe occasionally water, but wind is doing a lot of the work. And it's just physically breaking down those particles to smaller and smaller particle sizes, turning it into dust eventually. And what you end up happening is you'll get a strength-related sorting, just like you do on the Earth. You know, you take your granites and you grind it down and you're left with the quartz because it's got the hardness, the high hardness. On Mars, you're left with the olivine, which has almost the same hardness as quartz. And all, you know, the pyroxene, the feldspars, all that stuff ground down to dust because you've got billions of years for that to happen. So lots of places we do see olivine enrichments associated with the sand, but it's, you know, getting down to really fine-grained sand and silt-sized particles.
So given the cooler conditions, the different soil forming factors on Mars, they can still, there's still cement fiber steaming up there. And so mm-hmm. that suggests that there must have been water for some
yep.
substantial amount of time. However, maybe it's just order of the magnitude in my brain, maybe it wasn't significant. And what are your thoughts on that in terms of, like, how does that tell you how long there was water on the surface?
No, sadly, you know, we don't have good ways to do age dating. There, you know, we can count craters and look at relative differences in impact cratering on a regional scale. But again, nobody's yet built the shoebox size potassium argon dating system to put on a rover, although people are working on it. I think that I had some other answer, now I can't remember. What was the first part of your question again?
So that's asking about how, because it's a cooler condition.
Right, that's what it was. So the smectites that are there, the jarosite, the gertite has been found, all of it is thermodynamically unstable. None of it should be there. But the temperatures are so low that the E to the minus T term is ridiculously tiny. So the rates are so incredibly low in the alteration and that transformation, mineral transformations, that sure, they're unstable, but they're still there. Okay.
One last question.
You mentioned this need for collaboration between terrestrial and space scientists. What kind of advice do you give the audience about how can we facilitate these type of collaborations in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that one way to do it is through meetings like this and meeting people. Another way to do it is through the literature. Volunteer yourself to be a reviewer for papers in JGR Planets. Volunteer to NASA headquarters to be a reviewer of proposals related to studies of fine-grained regolith. I mean, we have major programs that we submit proposals to. How many does MDAC get every year? Hundreds. Hundreds of proposals go in every year from the planetary science community to a Mars program specifically. Meet some planetary scientists, go get some drinks, talk soils, convince them that you have experience that is absolutely relevant to what we're seeing on other planets, and I predict that your input would be highly welcomed.
Let's give Jim another round of applause.